chapters 7 through 10 of the book of Exodus. In this section, we will study 9 different plagues or signs that afflict the land and the people of Egypt. Blood, frogs, gnats, flies, dead livestock, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and finally, and not today in this study, the death of the firstborn. Welcome to the Good Word. That wasn't the best introduction, was it, because of all of these plagues? But here we are. We continue our series on the book of Exodus. I am your host, Tiago Ahais, and I'm joined by my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. And if you're not a fan of plagues, skip to the next lesson. Chapter 7 to 10, we cover the first 9 plagues. A lot happening in these chapters. I was reading some of the rabbis' discussions on the particularities of each one and what they could mean. It's in this sequence of texts that we find the whole conversation that people love to discuss about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Is it God who hardens Pharaoh's heart? Is it Pharaoh who hardens his own heart? And we have basically here the socio-economic breakdown of the land of Egypt to the point that the people turn to Pharaoh and say, there's nothing left, friend. Why are you still keeping the people here? I think the only question I have for you guys today, and we'll go with it, is what should we remember from these plagues? What did they convey about God's relationship to oppressive powers, as we discussed before? And how does all of these things anticipate future movements of God and people in the Hebrew Bible? What are you thinking?
I can't help but go back a little bit.
Take us back, Jody.
Like if you think back to the opening pages of Exodus, what you have depicted is essentially, and maybe we could go back even more to the closing of Genesis as well, but you have this emphasis on storing up and protecting resources.
Yep.
And that sense of scarcity and shutting off, and the idea that if I and my people are going to be safe, I must stockpile and protect, even to the point of dehumanizing myself and others. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that feels significant to me to go back to that image. Mm-hmm. But when we get to the progression of the so-called plagues, there's a sense in which I think that overall the book of Genesis is juxtaposing two things. Later in the book, we're going to have this revelation of the God who is a God of compassion, you know, like a mother who holds her newborn child on her arm, in her hand, and looks in the face and is responsive to, you know, hears the cries. And it seems to me, and I can't help here also to think about Walter Brueggemann. We're recording this in a few weeks before the quarter begins, and he's just passed away a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he talked a lot about in his work on the book of Exodus the idea of the God in Exodus is a God of freedom. He talked about the religion of the freedom of God. Mm-hmm. And this is juxtaposed with Pharaoh, whose heart becomes harder and harder and harder. And we could say, oh, it's because Pharaoh is going against the creator God and disconnecting from this creator God who is the source and sustainer of all elements of life for both him and his people, you know. But I also think that there's an intentional contrast that I would just like to invite us to be mindful of this progression of hardening one's heart, where you cannot be moved by another. Mm. And that's juxtaposed with a God who is dynamic in this relational responsive dance with the people and asking, not only is God moved by the people, but also asking the people to be moved by what they see in each other, by how their behavior affects others. So it just feels like an important contrast, the scarcity versus the abundant provider sense of how reality works, and then this progression toward dehumanization in the sense of hardening of hearts compared to the softening of hearts.
Yeah. Contrast between Pharaoh and God. No, I like this idea of Brueggemann, freedom of God, for sure. And it's great that we honor him in our talk here today. What I love about Brueggemann talking about it, if I remember well, is that the freedom of God is a problem to Pharaoh, right? In this society that is already structured around the moods of empire, of control of resources, of scarcity for everybody else, of labeling people and distributing in a particular way without mercy or justice, which will be characteristics of Hebrew society in Torah. It's amazing that God's freedom becomes a problem. Because this God of Israel cannot be contained within that system of gods that legitimize the authority of Pharaoh. So Pharaoh sits at the top of this situation in which the gods sustain and approve whatever is being done. So from what I remember, in prophetic imagination, he writes about how the way to put into check or to question the leader at the top is to question its gods that sustain that structure in place. Mm. So part of what we find in the plagues is sort of God showing that there is a freedom here that is not submissive to the structure of empire. And I will undo all of these little pillars that legitimize the rule of the one who keeps you in this situation of oppression. A second thing, and I think irony is big on this very point in the contrast between God and Pharaoh too, because Pharaoh is supposed to be the one who rules the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he can't control himself in this
and
hardening.
And he's depicted as brittle.
For sure.
Which you know, the whole concept of what gives you more freedom, you know, to have a soft, pliable heart or a mm-hmm. brittle one. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, Parker Palmer uses that image, you know, when he talks about the soft mm-hmm. heart. If you throw something brittle, it shatters mm-hmm. into a bunch of sharp pieces that then cause more harm.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a soft, supple heart, you can be affected by without perpetuating and
more
promulgating
pain.
More pain.
I love that image. And I think what's significant here is to notice that Pharaoh's hardening heart only turns to God being the agent of the hardening after the sixth plague to show that the beginning, the first five plagues, it's him sort of experiencing these things all the way to the end where he loses it completely. That's number one irony. This irony ties me back to Matilda's point on the women in the beginning of Exodus. Starts with Pharaoh's daughter, who... ironically, the daughter of the one who rules the world is the one through whom the leader of the people will come through because of her protection, because of her care, and because she is responding to a greater rule or a greater morality than the one served by empire. Maybe the third thing we can mention in this whole point of plagues here too, tied to what you're saying, Jody, is just how humans are prone to chaotic dynamics. Torah has already told us in the book of Genesis with the story of the flood of the human capability for evil and afflicting others and violence that leads to the undoing of creation, right, with the flood. Out of that chaotic environment, you have the first big building project in Torah, which is the building of the Ark. Book of Exodus is a parallel to that, meaning there's chaos, there's violence, all intentions of Pharaoh's heart are toward evil. Nature becomes to be undone because of that as a covenant partner, right? If we're going to stretch it, it's that it responds to this kind of violence. And later in Exodus, we have the second big building project, which is the sanctuary, which is supposed to be the reminder of what society is to look like in opposition to and as an alternative to, if we're going to use Brueggemann language, to empire. So just a few things for us to consider here too. Matilda, you've been quiet in the corner there. Tell us what you're thinking.
I was wondering, what do you make of the plagues in the sense that Pharaoh has destroyed, basically, the empire
yep.
he himself. He was scared that the people would take over,
mm-hmm.
and then he destroys the people
mm-hmm.
for it. And with that, when he destroys the people, he destroys his own
yep.
kingdom
yep.
in the end. But now God, in a way, does something similar. Lowers himself to the place, okay, if you destroy, I can destroy.
Yeah.
How about that? And so the plagues become an undoing of the blessings and the yeah. fruitfulness of the land. And
instead of light, there's darkness.
You, yes, yeah. yes, all of that. And God is the one in charge throughout all of that. So how do you think of God in this particular section in the book of Exodus?
Mm-hmm.
A God who is also able to say, okay, if you destroy, I can destroy even more.
Yeah, no, for sure. And while my tendency back in the day was always to find the humanistic, you know, possibility, in this season of my life, especially teaching Hebrew prophets, which is a class both of you have taught as well here at Walla Walla University, there are some texts that you just have to sit with them and consider what happens within in Torah often, not often, but sometimes gives us these glimpses into the divine heart. Flood is one of them, right? What do I do with this situation here? Exodus, we don't have that window into the heart of God. We just see these actions happening. What I take from it is instead of trying to soften it or to make sense of a humanistic God, I'm just puzzled, shocked, and I'm not going to say inspired, but moved in knowing that God is not passive toward the drastic nature of these dehumanizing actions taking place in Egypt. That the dehumanization of the other, that oppression, that slavery are things that God considers this grave to the point of saying, okay, this is what's going to happen for the people to be delivered. An Adventist twist into this is that the early church pioneers, even the Millerites back in the day, picked up on this imagery of Pharaoh and Egypt to feel their modern concerns over slavery in America, meaning that they saw a one-to-one relation between what was happening there, the three angels' messages, Babylon, empire, and slavery being part of that, and their presence in the world at the time. Obviously, they weren't rooting for plagues, but it caused them to move toward the world without a passivity that you often find in Christian settings today. So I wonder if there's something there, Matilda, that God is not just this passive, static, as you mentioned before, Jody, being, but he feels and he moves and he acts. Whether I am okay with the mode or not, instead of resolving, I just try to sit there with that tension.
So there has to be a certain kind of undoing before a new world comes.
I like that.
To us.
Back to Tohu Vavohu before Let There Be Light comes out again. Yeah.
And we'll see that same cycle, you could say, repeat. Because if you think of the imagery in the prophetic texts later on, they'll use a callback to the Exodus to describe the deliverance out of empire yet again. And before that, the way they describe the work of empire, the dehumanizing work of empire, is by essentially saying that God caused the Babylonians, the Assyrians, these major empires to carry out curses against the people. So it was all understood in this sense of, okay, this is the undoing, and then the rebuilding is like a reversal of that undoing. And now instead of planting a vineyard and having the enemy harvest the fruit, now you're going to get to plant it and you're going to be there in peace long enough to harvest the fruit.
I mean, the relation between these things, number one, foreigners within the land and nature, is significant in Exodus and later too. I think back to a point you were making before, Matilda, is the sense that in whatever the Jewish society will become in the future, there are going to be many texts saying, remember who you were in Egypt. Remember who you were in Egypt, especially when we get to the laws concerning the stranger, is that whatever you do to the stranger within your walls ends up having an effect on yourself and your people and nature as well. All of these things are interconnected. We see that in Exodus, and we're going to see that in the Hebrew prophets for sure if we extended the lesson into Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, minor prophets. The people suffer by how we treat each other and others. The land suffers with the same amount of grief. How are we to live? The answer hides in these pages of the book of Exodus. My thanks go to my conversation partners, Matilda and Jody, program engineer, Corin Bailey, and to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Thiago Ahais.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.